Side, because I'm going to be making repeated references to the database because I've used it for quite a lot of information about the camps. It's hosted by this university on the university library website, so it can be found there. That's a terrible URL to try and remember, but I'll just put it up in case people are interested. What it does have, if you do have ancestors who were in the camps, it's the camp registers, and so you should be able to find, if you're lucky, you'll find information about them, where they came from, which camp they were in, when they went in, when they left, that sort of thing. And this was the slide that I ended with last week, and then rather hurriedly, ended rather hurriedly, but I just wanted to say a little bit again about the location of the camps. As I say, this group of camps here were only set up in 1902 when they began to move people down to the coast, and that is true of the majority of the Natal camps as well, apart from Pietermaritzburg and Howick, which are early camps. The oddity is Port Elizabeth, which was always run by the military. It was never part of the other camp system, and so we don't have an awful lot of information about it. The great majority of the camps were in the Free State and the Transvaal along the railway lines. And this gives both black and white camps. But there were a scattering in the Cape as well. So there was one in Adels North, Norwell's Pond, Orange Station, Kimberley, Fryburg, and then Mafeking up at the top are all in the Cape. So there were this, they were part of the more permanent camp system. The Mafeking camp may well be the earliest camp. And then this was the slide I forgot to show yesterday. I forgot to put in. And just to show you the ages of the men in the camps, that this was not a camp of, these were not camps of old men. These were camps of young men, as far as the men were concerned. And this is the kind of information which I'm able to get from the database because the camp registers put in the ages of everybody. And I'll show you that later on. Anyway, let's turn now to what I'm going to be talking about today, which is largely about the mortality in the camps. Because the camps are remembered above all for the deaths, especially the deaths of the children. Just under half the children in the camps died, which is a terrible indictment. Or remembered also for the dreadful food, so it's these kinds of things that I want to look at. I should explain that my research on the camps about 10 years ago now was funded by the Wellcome Trust in Britain, and the Wellcome Trust funds research into medical history. So the research was the focus of the research was a medical history of the camps, which is why I've been looking at the camp through that particular lens. But as I went along, it seemed to me that by looking at the camps through the medical lens, you begin to understand the camps in a slightly different way. So that's what I'm going to try and show you today. Just to give you a little bit, for those of you who are not familiar with the background of medical history, there were two great advances in medicine in the 19th century, two great leaps forward. The first of them is associated in Britain with the work of Edwin Chadwick, arising actually out of the Poor Law Act, was the realization that clean water and good sanitation were fundamental to preventing infectious disease. This is what we're looking at in these camps, is the story of infectious disease of public health medicine. And it's difficult now to emphasize in the world that we live in just how important that discovery was. It made city life possible. In the Middle Ages, when you went into the cities, it was a good 80% chance that you were going to die of disease. People went into the cities to die, and the cities grew only through a process of migration from the countryside. So it's this discovery that makes the modern world as we know it possible. The second great leap forward, of course, many people are familiar with, is the understanding of the germ theory of disease, the recognition that disease is the product not of bad air, but of living organisms. And in the context of the camps, sanitation, of course, good sanitation, could prevent these organisms from proliferating. People sometimes ask about the role of antiseptic and aseptic surgery. That really isn't as relevant in the camps. It matters enormously for military medicine. But as I say, what we're looking at in the camps is a story of public health rather than surgery. This is the last of the typhoid wars, however. Typhoid was always the great killer in wartime. Even in this war, in the Anglo Boer War, the South African War, more British soldiers died of disease than they died of war wounds. But this was the last major war in which this happened, and it was a disgrace that it occurred. It was a comment on the poor quality of British military medicine and the callousness of the military authorities. Typhoid, the typhoid bacillus, had already been, the disease was well understood by 1899. The bacteria was identified in 1884. By 1896, there was a good diagnostic test for diagnosing the disease. And by 1899, just before the war started, a man called Dr. Almroth Wright, who worked at the British Military Hospital in Netley in the UK, had developed a vaccine which worked. But it wasn't much used in this war. It was seen as too experimental. It was used in the First World War, but not in this war. Bad decision. About 8,000 British soldiers died in consequence. Despite this knowledge, although they knew quite a lot about typhoid, typhoid wasn't easily controlled because it is a complex disease. It can be disseminated, it can be spread in many ways. Above all, of course, it's a disease of sanitation, a disease of bad water supplies, infected water supplies, which is how it spreads through the, down through the Modder River and into the Bloemfontein water supplies. But it's also spread by, for instance, on contaminated clothes. It can even, it's thought, be spread through dust. And the camps were constantly swept by dust storms. The Highveld can be very, very dusty in summer. It was a horrible place to be. Well, they were horrible places. But most mysterious of all with typhoid, it can also be spread by individuals who are not ill themselves. And the classic case is a woman called Typhoid Mary in New York, who was perfectly healthy but worked in kitchens. And everybody feeding from these kitchens, or many people feeding from these kitchens, fell ill from typhoid. And it took a long time before they discovered it was she who was the problem. So, as I say, it's not an easy disease to contain, and it's not always easy to diagnose either. It can present in quite a variety of different forms. But above all, there's fever, and the patients may die of fever. In addition to this, the disease damages the intestines, and you can get peritonitis, you can get ruptured intestines, and die from that. Treatment, therefore, was primarily a diet, a bland diet of things like milk and eggs and careful nursing. The point that I wish to make is that although typhoid was greatly feared, by 1900 it was a manageable disease. And it was managed in the camps. There was quite a lot of typhoid in the camps. I mean, I think in a place like Bloemfontein it was impossible to keep it out. Every water supply in Bloemfontein was infected. But it was never the great scourge that the authorities feared. But it meant that in order to prevent typhoid, they were obsessed with sanitation. They were obsessed with cleanliness. And there's another side to the story of cleanliness as well. Because cleanliness for the Victorians also carried moral connotations. I'm afraid I've quoted this little piece, which comes from a handbook written by the son of a missionary, Eastern Cape missionary. Because it just sums up so beautifully what people were saying about cleanliness in the 19th century. Attention to the laws of health is a public as well as a private duty. People must be taught that attention to public health is a moral duty, that cleanliness, avoidance of excess, and health preservation go hand in hand with mental and moral training, and that morality consists as much in a hearty submission to the precepts of health as to the observation of creed. And this is precisely the way the British were thinking in the camps, and why they cast these aspersions, or partly why they cast the aspersions on the Boers as dirty Boers. I want to emphasize, however, so what I'm saying then is that for the Victorians then, cleanliness was one of the hallmarks of civilization. But I want also to be absolutely clear that there's a world of difference between aspiration and fulfillment, and what the doctors are saying, and what is actually happening in Britain. Because the English, the British, were no cleaner than anybody else. This is a very middle-class attitude. The British working classes lived in enormous squalor in those industrial cities. And I'm sure that some of you had the same sort of experiences as I had when we first went to England in about the 1960s. And I thought, gee, British are dirty people. And there are many stories that I can talk about this difference in perception about cleanliness. The point I'm trying to make here then is that this whole language of cleanliness, this discourse of cleanliness and the dirtiness of the enemy is part of the rhetoric of empire. It's part of the rhetoric of war. It is not the objective reality. That is a different issue altogether. I think it's also worth understanding a bit about the limits of medical knowledge in 1900, because it does affect also what happens in the camps. First of all, viruses had not yet been identified. That means that when, and I'm going to come and talk about measles in a moment, measles could not yet be, the cause of measles was not yet known. The second thing, and I'll be saying a little bit more about that in the next lecture, is that there were remarkably few therapies to cure disease. There was the smallpox vaccine, of course. There was a diphtheria antitoxin. There was the typhoid vaccine. There was quinine. But that was about all. Aspirin was developed in 1899. There were no antibiotics. There were no sulfur drugs. The way in which disease was tackled was very limited. It was almost wholly through sanitation and careful nursing. The third point is that a little bit of knowledge could be a dangerous thing. I'm not going to be saying a great deal about scurvy, but scurvy is a disease which was rife in the camps. And what tended to happen here was that by this time we're onto germ theory of disease. Disease is caused by organisms, it's caused by pathogens. And so although they knew, and they'd known since the 18th century, that things like lime juice could prevent scurvy, they didn't know why. And so you begin to get, and by this stage, you begin to get doctors speculating that perhaps scurvy is a sort of toxin in the way that diphtheria is a toxin. And then why does lime juice work? Well, maybe it's a sort of antibacterial agent. So by this stage, in fact, researchers were going off in completely the wrong direction, because it was hard to understand they didn't know about vitamins, and it was hard to understand that disease or illness could be caused by an absence of something rather than a presence of a pathogen. And here I'm going to come to measles, because measles is the great killer in the camps, as I'll be showing you. And it is an extraordinary disease. And this is a slight digression, it's beginning to come back to some extent because people are not always being vaccinated. And quite a lot of medical researchers are very concerned about a resurgence of measles, and for very good reason, because measles epidemics have been terrible things. The form of measles that most of the camp doctors were familiar with was the form of measles that we tended to, probably too many of us, to encounter when we were children. It was a mild childhood disease. And this form of the disease tends to occur in quite large populations. It's estimated that you need a population of about 150,000 in a town or a city to sustain measles as an endemic disease, where it's there all the time, but it's not very virulent. And South Africa was too small, population was too small to sustain this form of measles. So what you tended to get in South Africa then was a country which is swept periodically by much more severe epidemics. Measles really is one of the world's most lethal diseases. It's highly infectious. It gains in virulence in conditions of deprivation. And recent research has shown, for instance, that in overcrowded homes, the pathogen, the virus, can increase in virulence as it passes through a family. You've got a large family in an overcrowded situation. A Danish researcher has done this sort of work. Good nutrition is also important in preventing severe measles. In South Africa, in the camps, the most common after effect of measles was pneumonia or bronchitis, particularly pneumonia. And it was often the pneumonia that killed the children rather than the measles. They get over the measles and then they fall ill with pneumonia. And the reason for this is that measles damages the mucous membranes of the body. So if you remember, when we were children, we were often put into darkened rooms because the eyes could be affected, the lungs could be affected, the intestine could be affected. So again, you also got this problem of digestive problems. And as in typhoid, then the best treatment was warmth and careful good food and careful nursing. And without this, you began to get this phenomenon that Emily Hobhouse called the faded flowers. This terrible photograph is probably the best known photograph associated with the camps. It's the photograph of Lizzie van Sale, who died of typhoid in Bloemfontein camp. And it appears in every single book about the camps. But it's actually an image with quite a complex history, which I'm not going to try and go into here, because the point that I want to make is that this terrible emaciation can be the product of typhoid. It was a phenomenon which was known in Europe as well, in Britain, this wasting of the children. Why children just don't seem to be able to absorb nourishment and get better when they've been ill. And you get this host of names for them. They call it inanition. They call it... I've gone blank and I haven't written down the names. Mesenteric tarbes is another name which was sometimes given. You get a whole series of these sort of terms to describe this emaciation and the failure to recover and just gradually to fade away and die. It was one of the great tragedies of the camps, but it was the product of diseases like typhoid and measles. And before I go back to the question of disease, I just want to talk a little bit about what went wrong in the camps, because I think one needs to understand what's going on behind these epidemics. When we started working on the camps, my colleague and I was working with an English colleague at that stage, kept saying, what went wrong? Why couldn't they get their heads around it? Why didn't they take action earlier on? And the answer is not simple. It's not easy to find. But an absolutely critical one seems to have been this question of a divided responsibility. And I've given here a little brief outline of some of the first steps in the establishment of the camps. As I say, in September of 1900, you begin to get the first official notice that camps are going to be formed by the military. At the end of November, beginning of December, Kitchener replaces Roberts. On the 20th of December 1900, he sent out this notice that Boers who surrendered voluntarily would be protected in government lagers in these refugee camps. And this is why they get the name refugee camps. So the early camps did have numbers of people who came in for protection as a result of this order. And then as the numbers increased, Kitchener wanted to get rid of these camps. He wanted nothing to do with managing civilians. And so on the 7th of March of 1901, you get Army Order No. 1, which handed the camps over to civilian administration. He'd actually done this already. But the civilian administration was a very nominal civilian administration, as I'll show you in a moment. And what made it even more nominal, because it's now in Milner's hands, was the fact that in those critical months of 1901, Milner went to England. He was away between May of 1901 and came back on the 27th of August. So for that period, Kitchener, who was utterly uninterested in the camps, remained theoretically responsible for the camps. And I think that did make a difference, because Kitchener's staff were scared of him. They didn't want to tell him that the camps were a disaster. And I'll show you why in a moment. I think the other thing that went wrong with the camps was this question of gender. This is a very, Victorian world is a very male world, and war is men's business. Women and children, civilians, were irrelevant to the central preoccupation of the authorities. I think that the women and children were, in a way, simply overlooked. They were just relegated to second place and not given much attention. And you can find this in the kind of assumptions that they make about the refugees or about the camp inmates. Milner always refers to them as he, although this is supposed to be a camp, they're supposed to be camps of women. When he talks about relief earlier on, he's thinking in terms of conventional poor relief with men out digging roads. For women and children whose husbands are out on commando, you know, there's something very odd going on in the thinking there. So, as I've suggested here, the special needs of women and children were not considered. There was no woman appointed to any senior camp administration. So there was no woman whose voice was heard for a long time. Later on, but not for a long time. Just to return to this question of a divided responsibility in a militarized world, the man who was responsible for the Transvaal camps and sort of the overall camps was this man, General Sir John Maxwell, who was the military governor of Pretoria, So you've got a military man at the head of affairs. This is Lucy Dean's quotation about him. Lucy Dean was one of the women on the Ladies' Commission, and she said he was fat, good-looking, lazy, and kind. And there are various other similar remarks about him. Pleasant enough chap, mildly interested in the camps. He had an American wife who was a bit more interested in the camps, but he did not want to upset Kitchener. And I think that's the critical thing. And when you move to the Free State, you get the same sort of story. The Free State was headed by the Deputy Administrator, Major Sir Hamilton Gould Adams, chap who'd been in Mafeking with Baden-Powell, another military man. And who does he appoint as the overall camp superintendent, the chief superintendent? But yet another military man, Captain Trollope, and a man, I would point out, of an extraordinarily low rank. So Trollope in the Free State really had very little authority. And as I've said there, he was alternately patronized, teased, and bullied by Gould Adams. And you can see this in Gould Adams' comments on Trollope's letters to him in the Free State archives when Trollope occasionally tries to push him into some sort of action. Then you get these violent reactions. Stop trying to bully me. I'm in charge, this sort of thing. And again, I think that Gould Adams did not want to disturb Kitchener. But the other absolutely critical element in the camps were the superintendents. And you got very different kinds of superintendents. When you're looking at a bad camp, 80% of the time you're looking at a weak superintendent, an incompetent superintendent. And this man, Russell Deer, is an example of the kind of thing that happens. Russell Deer was a civilian. He came from Port Elizabeth. He was noted in Port Elizabeth as a great sportsman. Why he came to the camps is a bit of a mystery. But anyway, he came. And when the Boer families start pouring in, he goes into total panic and he sends off repeatedly these agonized memos to Trollope. Please send me tents. Please send me more tents. I haven't got any food. Please inquire where fault lies in sending me at a day's notice close on 1,000 refugees without any rations or tent accommodation. A month later, almost 100 refugees arrived, and I have no tents for them. On the 9th of June, just heard the 300 refugees will arrive at 7 p.m. I must have 100 tents at once. Otherwise, women and children will have to remain in the open veldt. And indeed, this is what kept happening, because the military would round up the families, bring them into the camps without any prior warning, although they were supposed to give notice and allow the camp superintendents time to get food and get tents for them. Just about never happened. Nevertheless, in marked contrast to Russell Deer, you get this man, St. John Cole Bowen, who crops up all the time, and every time anybody comments on Cole Bowen, they comment favorably about him. And this is Emily Hobhouse, that he possessed marked administrative powers. His rule was firm, just, and kind, and he seemed possessed of unlimited resources. He could always produce those tents. He could always produce the food. He could get things going. He was at Norval's Pond camp, and then he later on became an inspector of the camp, so you'll see him cropping up later on. At the end of the war, he became resident magistrate for Wynberg, and he remained in the Free State for the rest of his life. I met his granddaughter, and who they still live in South Africa. So he was a man who settled in South Africa. He came from Ireland originally, and his family think perhaps that's why he was kindly disposed towards the Boers. So you've got a very different kind of man, and Norval's Pond is a different kind of off-camp, as I'll show you. But there are other things also going on in these camps, which I think one needs to understand why the Boers were so desperately unhappy in these camps. Because despite the administrative difficulties, despite the lack of order in some respects, the camps were not themselves lacking in order. And I would argue that one reason why the Boer families found the camps such alien places was that there they were confronted with a wholly different set of ideas about how the world should be organized. In a sense, what happened to the Boers when they came into the camps was the sort of rapid and forced urbanization that occurred in Europe's industrial cities, where people are suddenly pouring into cities which are unprepared for them, which lacked suitable sanitation, which lacked adequate accommodation, and where the factory owners are trying to enforce a new kind of discipline on them, a discipline where you arrive at work on time and you work to the clock. And all this imposed on people who are accustomed to rising with the sun and working to the rhythms of the day and the seasons. So, as I'm saying, what was happening was that the discomforts of the camps were bad enough, but in addition there is this imposition of these rigid routines. This photograph is a photograph of Norval's Pond camp, and you're looking north across to the Orange River and to the modern-day Gariep Dam. And perhaps I'll just make one other point about this photograph. While I was working on the camps, a lot of people have got in touch with me through the website, and a woman got in touch with me and said her great-grandfather had been a professional photographer in Norval's Pond camp. And she sent me, she had his photograph album, and she sent me photographs from his album. Now, his photographs were quite widely disseminated, so that this photograph, for instance, I actually got from the War Museum in Bloemfontein. And it's been used a lot because it is a beautiful photograph. But he was a very good photographer. And so we get these photographs often in the camps taken by professional photographers who are themselves camps inmates, but who are wanting to make a bit of money, and people, if they had a little bit of money, had their photographs taken. There are many, many camp photographs, and this is one of the reasons why. Anyway, just to get back to the reason why I put up this photograph, it's because I think it illustrates so beautifully the British notions about how a camp should be organized, with these rigid lines, neat, tidy, looks good. But this kind of tidiness is all about power and order and surveillance. That's not how the Boers wanted to live. The Boers wanted to live within their wagons, close to their friends and family. The British, on the other hand, want these widely spaced streets through which sanitary wagons could pass. So repeatedly in reading these camp reports then, one sees this comment about, oh, it's so untidy, it hasn't got these nice straight streets. Proper management then is about this kind of thing. And just to remind you, when I was talking about the workhouses, I said workhouses are also partly about surveillance, about order of this kind. And I think it's the same kind of mindset to some extent that is going on there. The other sort of thing that is going on then also is the control of time. They're now living to a rigid timetable. This timetable here comes from an early Transvaal camp report. Whether it was actually implemented, I don't know. But you can see the sort of timing that they were working to. 9 o'clock, no one could leave the camp before that. The camps were not totally enclosed. People could go out, they did in some cases go and work in the towns, they could go and shop in the nearby towns. They were not prisons. There were restrictions on movements, they had to have passes, but that is a country under martial law and everybody had to have passes. So they could go out, and then they got to roll up their tents to aerate them. They got to go and draw their rations. 11 o'clock cleaning is finished, 7 p.m. everybody has to be in, 9 o'clock lights out, etc., etc. And in some cases, as in Norval's Pond camp under Carl Bowen, you actually got a gong, because it's quite a rudimentary sort of gong. So time then is controlled as well. And then there is the whole question of the listing and the counting. These bureaucratic controls extended to listing and counting. The Boer republics, especially the Transvaal, had not been very good about this sort of thing. There were very few censuses, no registration of births and deaths, relatively little of the apparatus of the modern state. For the British, however, counting people was one of the hallmarks of civilization. And there's good reason for this. Anyone who knows anything about epidemiology knows that epidemiology, the study of infectious disease, starts with statistics. To understand the disease, you need to be able to count. You need to be able to count where that disease is appearing and who is getting it. So statistics are important then for the management of disease and for a whole lot of other things in the management of society as well. And in the camps, the British counted endlessly and listed endlessly. And I'm not going to go on too much about it, But one of the reasons why we've got this database was the existence of these camp registers. Unless it's got lost for some reason, every single camp has at least one register, and they're all more or less to the same formula. So that at the top you'll get the head of the family. Now this is Balmoral Camp Register, and in the Transvaal camps, this is what I'm saying about women and men, that Hermanus Jacobus is not a man, he's a woman, and I know he's a woman because that second column is the female column. And similarly, the one beneath Willem Stemberg, Britta, is also a woman. So the women in this camp are listed not under their own names, they lose their own identity, they're listed under their husbands' names. Then you get all the children followed and the ages of all these people. You get the date that they come into the camp. You get, in this particular case, what's happened to the husband, and we know for both of those the husband is a POW. You get the farm they come from, and because Balmoral is a good register, you also get the size of the land holding, or whether they own land. In this case, both of them do. And quite unusually, you get where the women were picked up, and they come in all sorts of reasons, and the date that they come in, and then who has died of the family, and when they leave. So there's a lot of information in those registers. They are probably the first really detailed demographic information that we have for the Boer republics. And demographers are now beginning to use this material precisely for that reason. I've just handed a whole lot of stuff over to Stellenbosch University, where they've got they're working on demography. So these registers then are part of this battery of counting and listing and statistics that the British went in for. One consequence, of course, of this listing and counting is that for historians then, we have an unusual amount of information about these camps. Far more information than you find in as I understand it, in the camps in Cuba and the Philippines, for instance, because the British did this in so much detail. Anyway, one of the things that I'm able to get from this database is the question of property ownership. And this just shows you, we list the head of the families, and then when the register, like Balmoral, we can list also what property they own. And it seems that rather few people actually owned much property. I think this is probably exaggerated, that there were more the people who might, for instance, rent land are not here in this sort of statistic. But nevertheless, it is an indication of the class divisions in Afrikaner society, that by and large the people in the camps were relatively poor people. You might ask what then has happened to the wealthier people, and I think the thing is that if people had more money, if they could support themselves, they didn't have to go into the camps, and they had various things that they could do. They were allowed to live in the towns and or in the dorps nearby, and the British actually increasingly encouraged that because they didn't want to pay for anybody they didn't have to pay for. Quite a lot of people went to join family in the Cape, so many of them go over the border into the Cape Colony to stay with family, or they go down to the coast, and a few who were more affluent even went overseas. And I know this because my great-grandfather was one of them, although he was a predicant, I don't think he was affluent, but he went overseas. So, you know, middle-class people had means of getting out of the camp. There were, of course, quite a lot of middle-class people in the camps, and anybody who was regarded as suspicious was forced to stay in the camps. In that sense, the camps were prisons. And the British were pretty paranoid, so you didn't have to say very much to be regarded with suspicion. But what I've been trying to say then is that what one's looking at in the camps is a camp largely, probably, of Bayboerners, of landless Boers, or people who have very little land and relatively few possessions. By far, the most criticized and critical aspect of camp life were the rations. This ration scale was the first ration scale that was published for so-called genuine refugees. And it's a bit of a problematic ration scale because at the same time there was a ration scale B, which was published. And I'm talking about something that's been published. The women whose men were on commando or prisoners of war were not given meat. Now, that is the published ration scale, but it's a bit of a read, and much has been made of it. and it comes up repeatedly. But in the first place, this ration scale was never implemented or published even for the Orange River Colony, and most of the camp supervisors refused to implement it, and it was abandoned in a month. So meat then was actually supplied to the camp inmates. But the problem was the quality of the meat. I should add also that a major consideration, well, first of all, who drew up these ration scales? We don't know who drew this one up, but it was probably a military doctor. And I want to make the point here that by 1900, nutrition is a relatively well understood science. People knew about calories. They knew how many calories were needed for survival, or calories were needed for men doing hard work, this kind of thing. They knew quite a lot about nutrition and about proteins. They didn't know about vitamins. Vitamins had not yet been identified. And the places where they learnt about ration scales, or they experimented on ration scales, was institutions like the workhouses or the army. So what you're getting here is the kind of ration scale that you'll find in a workhouse. And again, you can see how these things come together. But a second consideration in drawing up of these ration scales was economy. Milner, especially in the early days, was absolutely obsessed with the fear that the feckless careless management of the camps would lead to a feckless waste of money. And he keeps on going on about the fact that my only concern is to keep our total expenditure as low as possible. And later on, the whole question is one of immediate economy and efficiency. So economy is the watchword of the camps in the beginning. I should add that although this was what people received as ration scales, it wasn't the only resource for camp inmates. People often don't realize this, but nearly all the camps had shops. In the Transvaal, these shops were a monopoly by Poynton's brothers. In the Orange River Colony and elsewhere, there were a number of traders who competed with one another, which kept down the prices, of course, although the prices were regulated. You might say, where would these camp inmates get money to buy food from these shops? Well, they earned it in the camps. The second most important expenditure, or significant expenditure in the camps, was money paid to camp inmates working in the camps. Those camps could not have been run without the camp inmates doing things like the sanitary work, keeping it clean, and, as I'll show you later on, work nursing in the hospitals, a whole lot of things. They weren't paid huge sums of money. An issuer of rations got about 10 shillings a day, which was not bad at all, but probably most men would get 2 and 6 a day, something like that, which was not a lot of money, but it was enough to supplement the family's rations a bit in those shops. This is an unexpected man to find in the middle of the whole camp story. This man, Dr. John Scott Haldane, was the father of the better-known Marxist geneticist, J.B.S. Haldane. But in his own day, Dr. Haldane was a well-known figure. He was particularly interested in the physiology of respiration, and he was noted for conducting dangerous experiments on himself. He also played a very significant role in the First World War in developing gas masks, because it's respiration that he's interested in. He's a man on the political left, and as a man on the political left, he was a pro-Boer. In November of 1901, the War Office began to publish these blue books. I'm going to keep talking about blue books, and I'll explain what they are later on. But the first of the blue books to be published was one called CD819, which is a massive book consisting of Transvaal camp reports, correspondence of various kinds, and a whole lot of other stuff. And in amongst all of this was that ration scale, and other ration scales which were issued to the camp inmates. So Haldane sits down and analyzes that ration scale and then writes a long letter not to the War Office, but to the Colonial Office, and says, these people are starving. They are not getting enough calories, there is no fat in their diet, there are no fresh fruit or vegetables, and the food is totally unsuitable for babies. And in fairness to Joseph Chamberlain, the Secretary of State for the colonies, he no sooner got this than he sent the whole thing off for analysis to their own expert, a chap called Martin. And Martin came back with precisely the same story. The ration scales in the camps are totally inadequate. The people are starving. And so from that point onwards, they begin to improve the rations. And added to this also were the recommendations of the Ladies' Commission, and I'll be talking about the Ladies' Commission later on, who also recommended that the ration scales be improved, and because they were women, they were particularly conscious of the need for decent food for babies. So particularly the food for babies and toddlers was improved. But food is a fascinating subject, and it's a fascinating subject in this war, because food is a lot more than just nutrition, just survival. Food is partly what we are. Our identities, our culture, so often is tied up with what we eat and how we eat. And I've just put up these three slides just to remind you that for the British, for the Boers, and for black people, for all of them, the significant item of food was meat. For the British, they roast beef. For the Boers, well, the Boers were trying biltong in the camps, we know, because the British didn't like this habit of cutting up the meat and drying it. But meat was important for Africans. The cattle-based culture, meat was important. So meat is the single most important ingredient in the camps, and it was terrible. In the beginning, they got fresh meat, because all this, these cattle that were rounded up from the farms, many of them, many were killed, but many were taken either by the army and put onto army farms, or else many of the Boers were actually allowed to take meat into the camps. But it's a bad winter, the grass goes, the grazing disappears, and very quickly the quality of the meat began to disappear. So instead, what happened was that they turned to bully beef. Now, by 1900, we're well into an era of industrialization. The whole business of canning food, canning meat, is very well developed indeed. And I just put up these two illustrations to make two points. One, first of all, that the Boers hated the bully beef, and they were convinced it made them ill, but they weren't the only ones who thought that. When the British first encountered tinned meat, they felt the same way about it. So it's a matter of the unfamiliarity, which is really what it's about, rather than the quality of the meat. And the other point that I wanted to make is the sheer scale of what was required in the camps. This bully beef had to supply the British Army, it had to supply the camps, and it had to supply the civilians in the towns. We are looking at a very large-scale industrial process, and that meat didn't come from Britain. It came quite largely from Australia and also increasingly from the United States. And millions of tins of food were supplied to South Africa during this war. Now, one of the stories of the camps, along with the ground glass, is the story of hooks in the meat. And this particular picture comes out of a comes from the back of a book which was relatively recently published. I wouldn't deny for a moment that there were not some hooks in the meat. It seems to be entirely likely that they were. With so much food being brought in, I would guess that quality control wasn't immaculate, things might well have got into the meat just because of poor quality control. But there's another, I've got another suggestion as well, which is pure hypothesis on that on my part, and that is that in places like Australia and America, disaffected Fenians, disaffected Irishmen, thinking that they are now canning the meat for the British Army, might well have put in the So that's a hypothesis, I don't know. I think they probably didn't occur to them that it was going to the camps. So I think it's quite possible that there was, but there were hooks in the meat. I didn't deny that. Meat has got another place in the camps as well, because increasingly meat becomes a kind of a metaphor for well-being, an expression of the awfulness of the camps. And it centres particularly around this extraordinary episode of the Brandfort Meat Rebellion. And I'll just tell you very quickly the story. This rebellion started on the 7th of November of 1901, when some camp women, led by Maria Else, aged about 16, and Mrs. Isabella Vuvier, rose in revolt. They descended on what they called the Commandant, who was a Cape colonial called Jacobs, to complain about the inedible meat, which they said was old, thin, and full of vermin. Jacobs said, "It's fine, it's perfectly good enough for you." And he tried to punish the ringleaders. but the women would not allow it, and went forth with us two, all singing, and I, Maria Elps, carrying the Free State flag. So then he tries to take away the flag, Jacobs does. This is Jacobs, of course, hiding in the tent, confronted by these angry women. He tries to get the camp police to take away the flags and to arrest the ringleaders. And the women resist. They begin to strike, the police begin to strike them with sticks, and the women retaliate with wood and with bottles, eventually beating back their attackers. At this point, Jacobs, the superintendent, becomes a bit more conciliatory, and he agrees to provide them with better meat. But in fact, he was just playing for time. He hastily calls the British army in. The ringleaders are rounded up and taken before the provost marshal in Brandfort, and then sent to prison for a while in Bloemfontein. Now, there are no less than 8 versions of this story of varying kinds in the women's testimonies. There isn't a single mention of it in the official records. So it's a story that was important for the women. And it has this triumphalist tone. The women are proud and defiant. They're formidable ladies, in stark contrast to the bullying men who swear at them and beat them. It's women bonding as sisters who are carrying on the fight. Civilian women pitted against military men. But what is going on behind all this? Well, behind all this is the story of what is happening in Brandfort Camp. And this, as I said, happens in November. In October of 1901, the measles epidemic struck Brandfort. And the mortality rate absolutely rocketed. Brandfort was the very worst camp of all. In that terrible month of October, 373 people died, giving a death rate of 1,166 per 1,000. In other words, if people had continued to die at that rate, the camp would have died out. Everyone would have died. So it was a very terrible mortality lying behind this. But that's not the women. What the women complain about. The women complain about the meat, except for one woman, this Mrs. von Tonder. Now, whether she actually said this, I don't know. When this was written, we don't actually know. It may well have been written afterwards, because this statement encapsulates so many of the myths about the camps. But it seems to me it's beside the point, because what she's doing here is encapsulating the anger and the grief of those women who are protesting about the meat, but who are grieving for their dying children. She says, we're dying at the rate of 30 to 40 a day. You can't dig graves for them all. You can't make enough coffins. The bodies are simply rolled in blankets, and 4 bodies are placed in 1 grave, so the bodies lie only 4 inches under the solid earth. Mothers and children cannot visit their loved ones in hospital. Sometimes they stand for hours in the rain in front of the closed gate to hear whether the doctor won't let them greet their loved ones for the last time. And then we find them in the mortuary tent. Do you think we are dogs? The other item that there is a lot about in these camps is the milk. But I'm going over time again, so I'm going to move on quite rapidly. But essentially, fresh milk rapidly became unavailable. They got tinned milk. But there were real problems with tinned milk at this stage. Often it was not very good quality tinned milk. Or else it was the sweetened condensed milk that we know, which was not really very good for babies. Ideal milk was what the British really wanted, but they couldn't always get it, and many of the camps continued to order the sweetened condensed milk. So children then were not being fed suitable nutrition for quite a long time, until eventually the camp authorities took over the supply of milk and diluted it themselves, because that was what some of the complaints were about, and began to issue it themselves. So let's turn now to the question of mortality. This just gives you the outline of the mortality rates in the Transvaal and the Orange River Colony. And just to make 2 points about it. First, that the deaths peak round about November of 1901. And that for reasons that I'm not entirely clear about, the deaths in the Orange River Colony were slightly higher. This is a death rate. Was slightly higher in the Orange River Colony than it was in the Transvaal. What caused the deaths? Well, there's absolutely no question about it, and we've got causes of deaths. It's measles. above all. And you need to look at measles and respiratory diseases together, because as I pointed out, many of the children died of pneumonia after they'd had measles. So those two go hand in hand. And that is by far the greatest killer of the camps. Adults often died of typhoid. Babies often die of diarrhea, dysentery, gastroenteritis, those sorts of things. So these two, the typhoid and the diarrhea and dysentery, also go together. Other causes consist of all sorts of things. A little bit of cancer, things like heart complaints. The old people often die of senile dementia or senility, or they describe it in various ways like that. But what is also interesting about the mortality is what people don't die of. One of the diseases you don't get in the camps, or hardly at all, for instance, is tuberculosis. Now, tuberculosis is beginning to be a really serious disease in Cape Town, but it's not there in the camps. The other diseases that you don't get mentioned are in these camps of women are female-related diseases. There's barely a mention of it. So it's very hard to get at this. This, of course, is a Victorian era. They're very private about these sort of things. But you are not getting women, there's no mention of women dying of female-related diseases. And the one thing that the doctors were on the lookout for was puerperal fever, or diseases related to childbirth, because they very much objected to the poor midwives. This is a very a great thing with doctors at the end of the 19th century. Folk midwives are insanitary and undesirable in every possible way. So they're looking at the midwives. But there's very little death in childbirth in these camps. So that was not a problem either. Few people died of other things like accidents. One woman inadvertently poisoned herself at night. She drank rat poison, which was next to her bed. And that was quite carefully investigated. There was a train accident which killed some. There were several episodes, as we know, with the Highfield storms alike. There were several episodes when tents were struck by lightning, or people were struck by lightning and they died. Just to give you a sense of what camps were the worst camps, as I've mentioned, Brandfort is the very worst of all. Mafeking comes second. And down at the end we get our model camp, Norval's Point, Norval's Pond. Some of them are quite interesting. Irene, which there's a lot of literature about Irene. And if you read the literature, you would think it was an absolutely dreadful camp, and yet it is second only to Norval's Pond as far as at the lower end of the scale. So, and Batuli comes in somewhere around about the middle, which is another really awful camp. So it's camps like Brandfort, Mafeking, Standerton, Kroonstad, Nailstrom, those camps, which are really, Batuli's fairly high up, which are the really, really bad camps. Just to make the point very briefly, that not all the patterns of mortality in the camps were not always exactly the same, and you'll get a difference between a camp like Kroonstad, which is the classic epidemic camp, where the epidemic rises to a peak in a single month, and then the health begins to improve. But Batuli, on the other hand, has got a very different pattern. It's got this pattern that goes like this. So it's got a much more extended period of mortality. Goes on for much longer. And Batuli is one of those camps where you get a lot of typhoid as well as measles. So it's not only a measles camp, it's a typhoid camp as well. So it's a camp where health is far worse amongst the entire population, perhaps, than in Kroonstad, although ultimately the number of deaths in Kroonstad was very high. I wanted to leave you some time for questions, so I'm just going to go very quickly through this. But Mafeking camp is an unusual camp in that it had a very late onset epidemic of measles. We know that it was brought in by a family from Tong after the Ladies' Commission had already visited the camp. And the mortality rate soared. Once this family came in, the disease spread like wildfire through the camps. Because it's so late, the authorities and the Ladies' Commission both investigate what is going on. And that is the pattern of what's. Don't take any notice of that one at the end. That's what happens when you deal with statistics. You can have two people in the camp and one dies, and you get that kind of... but that's the pattern of mortality in the camp. But what, in fact, it turns out was going on in this camp was two things. One was doctors who were hardworking, well-intentioned, and poor administrators. And along with that, a camp superintendent who was also a poor administrator. And just to give you two quotations, the Dr. Kaufman, who resigns in despair and exhaustion and hands over to a much more competent doctor, says in a sort of aggrieved tone, "I should have asked for assistance, but as he replied to my first request that other larger camps have only one doctor, I resented it as a reproach and restrained from asking for more." And then McCart, once this all happens, who's the camp superintendent, the ladies' commission say of him that at first he seemed to be quite good. It was impossible not to contrast the attitude and manner of the superintendent on this occasion with that on our previous visit. He appeared as if incapable of realizing the gravity of the situation and was chiefly anxious to lay the whole responsibility for it on headquarters, reiterating his assertion that he had not been given the help he required. Careful examination of the correspondence shows that his assertion was not borne out by the facts. So you've got then a situation where a weak superintendent and not very competent doctors contribute to this very high mortality. I was going to conclude by looking very briefly at this man, but I think I'm going to carry him over till tomorrow and leave you some time for questions. Because he's an interesting figure and he tells you some interesting things about the camps. But I think I'll stop at this point and give you just a few minutes for questions. Anybody has any?
Can you briefly explain how the inmates or the residents of the camps were taken care of as far as their basic toilet needs and showering or cleaning, ablutions and things like that?
The early facilities were pretty awful. They used a trench system with a log of wood, and you had to sit on this log of wood over the trench. And children fell off and fell in. It was utterly revolting. The other problem, of course, was that many people had diarrhea and to be stumbling around in the dark trying to reach these tents on the outskirts of a camp that could be a mile long was pretty awful. So cleanliness was a real problem in the beginning. Later on, they introduced a bucket system, which seems to be much more efficient, and they began to use black labour to keep the toilets clean, the toilet system clean. It improved enormously, and they also began to use night toilets, so there would be toilets near the tents at night. So it became much more efficient. They also introduced showers. There were showers, and they encouraged the inmates to use the showers, and they certainly, a portion of them at any rate, certainly did so. They even, in some places later on, had swimming baths, and the children at any rate were swimming, and there were photographs of children swimming in these kind of tanks. So in the beginning then, the toilet facilities were pretty rudimentary and pretty awful, and it's not difficult to understand why it was so difficult to keep the camps clean. Later on, they were much more efficient and worked relatively well in a well-run camp. Somewhere like Norval's Pond had an efficient system from the beginning, but that's Carl Byrne for you. Sorry, the gentleman behind?
I just want to know, what was the sort of average daily water ration per person?
It varied quite a lot, and it depended very much on where the camp was. Bloemfontein had an appallingly small daily ration of, I think, about 2 pints a day, something absolutely ridiculous. Bloemfontein was very short of water, and it was contaminated water. They did gradually improve it a bit, but it was a terribly small amount of water. Camps like Norval's Pond or Orange River Station, or any of those that are on the Orange River, have got access to the river water, and all the ones on the Far River have got access to river water, and they are very much better. What happens afterwards is interesting, because the British begin to introduce really major engineering works. They have water engineers in the camps. They start to put in pumps, they're putting in pipes, they're putting in quite elaborate water systems for actually bringing water into the camps. A place like Frederford Road, the water was brought in by cart from a nearby watering place. So it varies where you are. But by the end, there were quite sophisticated engineering works put in place, and sometimes they sell them to the town at the end of the war. Sorry?
The database website.
Yes. Yes, I'll put it up again. That's probably easiest to go out. Sorry, and there was a question from... Yes.
Well, I just, it's not a question, just a statement, thinking about the trauma, the traumatic environment that those women, having seen their houses and their candlesticks and all the other things burnt, how that played out, you know, the level of depression and so on, the psychological part must have been undealt with.
Well, it was certainly undealt with by the authorities. Well, not wholly. I think that some of the superintendents did recognize that they had this thing about keeping people active. So they start to start societies, they start schools, they start sewing classes, they start music classes, they start glee clubs, all sorts of things to try and keep people active. But I think that depression was certainly a major factor. In a camp like Batuli, it's overwhelming. That's something I'm going to discuss in the last lecture. But it was a major problem, I think, for the women. How could it not be when they're losing their children on that scale?
And I also wondered whether they grew vegetables.
Yes, they did later on. Not in the beginning. But once you get this reform of the food, one of the things they start to do is to set up vegetable gardens. Yeah. Sorry, take the lady and then I'll continue.
Were the churches active? I mean, did they get church counselling?
Yes, they did. It was a slightly tricky thing. The British were rather suspicious of the Dutch Reformed Church ministers because they suspected them of being seditious. So they carefully vetted all the prelacons who came into the camps. But this, after all, is, you know, this is the Victorian age. You can't deny people their faith. And so certainly within a few months, every camp had at least one prelacont, sometimes more than one. And they talk all the time. They have church services all the time. There are churches set up. People writing about the camp say the Boer women sing hymns all day, or sing psalms. And occasionally you get information. There was one of the Natal camps, there was a sort of revival led by Andrew Murray, an evangelical revival. It's a very active religious life. Yeah.
Sorry, are we talking the statistics here of only the white camps? You said there were white
camps. Yes, these are only the white camps. I'm going to be talking about the black camps on Thursday, but the statistics here are only for the white camps, yeah. The records are quite different. Yeah.
Sorry, this is Smith Hydrate. I'm
No, it wasn't. There seem to have been two or three suicides. They were very careful about this sort of thing. When there was an untimely death, they had post-mortems and they had inquiries with the magistrate. And you've got the records there. So there don't seem to have been very many cases of suicides. I think perhaps because people were in communities. You know, that is a kind of a support, perhaps. And everybody's enduring the same thing. There was the occasional case of people who were seen to be so-called lunatic, as they used the term in those days, and there were two or three people who were removed from the camp and sent to asylums. And there was you got people in the camp who were disabled in various ways, and they'll talk about feeble-minded children or people who are disabled in other ways. There's certainly a proportion of people like that in the camps. Okay. Thanks very much.